Welcome back to Ashburton. We're about ready to start now.
It's Political Commentary.
With Rod Oram this morning. Kia ora, Rod. How are you today?
Morena, very well, Rachel. Thank you.
It's good to have you on the show. We are talking about another IPCC report, the International Panel of Climate Change, which has come out this week, and it's looking at mitigation and also what people can be doing on an individual level as well as on a more governmental and systemic level to make some change to sort of mitigate what's going on at the moment. Having a look at this report, what is your biggest takeaway from it, first of all?
That the time is virtually run out for us to be able to get to 1.5 degrees centigrade, the level at which we can cope best with the changing climate. Now, we've known that's been building up on us for a while, but it just shows even more forcefully than ever that we're just not responding big enough, fast enough. And my concern here is that so many people feel there's very little they can do. Mm. And I want to just emphasize to people that each of us can only do this infinitesimally small thing. Mm-hmm. But if a vast, almost an infinite number of us actually do our infinitesimally small thing, that does add up.
Yeah.
So it's a question of trying to persuade people, encourage people to think about this and to think about ways they can make some changes in their life to reduce the carbon that they're generating, and sort of spread the word. And so for me, this is really now about behavior change. And very interestingly, for the first time in an IPCC report, they actually had a whole chapter on behavior change, chapter 5. And in many ways, for me, that's the most important chapter in the whole report.
So tell us a wee bit about that chapter. What does it actually say? Because I think you're so right in pointing out that people can feel very disempowered by climate change because it's such a huge thing. How can your small action make a difference? What does this chapter actually say when it comes to that?
In classic IPCC style, it's an incredibly comprehensive view of the science. It's looked at a vast number of social science papers and studies and explain the various mechanisms by which people can be encouraged to change their behavior. That's the essential theme of the report, of that chapter. And it's got very subtle ones, like these are called the nudge ones, where governments and others sort of give us these little clues to nudge us in the right direction. Rather more structured ones help reorient what we do. And I think this is a very, very neglected work. And crucially, it also takes us into that area of a just transition. So it's that the people who bear a substantial cost of this are helped through that. So nobody is disadvantaged by that, by the change. Because at the heart of this is a really important concept too. In making these changes, we will all be better off, not just because we'll have a more stable climate and we'll still be able to produce more food and all that kind of stuff, but in terms of lower cost for energy, for example. So it's really important to keep emphasizing to people tremendous upsides for responding to this, but also, of course, being steely-eyed about the downside of this if we don't substantially increase our rate of carbon reduction.
And when it looks at a government level, what are some of the things it's suggesting or saying we need to be doing? Because as you mentioned, you need to kind of have both of these things happening at once. Otherwise, these small actions, they need to be supported by the big systemic changes. What kind of stuff was it mentioning in this report?
In one sense, it's a playbook in terms of all the policy levers you might pull. It's very mindful that it's addressing this to politicians, and therefore it's not telling them what to do.
Yep.
It's laying out various options. But to me, as far as I can tell from whole reports, it is huge, and I have only skimmed parts of it, is that it's not dealing with the politics of this, and that's where I think we're in real trouble here and around the world. And we have all sorts of insights about how people form their opinions on climate and other issues and how that works through in the political process. But it's the political processes that are letting us down comprehensively.
Mm.
And I think that, along with behaviour change, and the two go absolutely hand in hand, are where we need to apply our efforts. Because we know the science, the technology for doing this is moving along very fast and very productively. So it's the behavior change and the politics of this, hand in hand, which is the absolute key to that. And rightly, this report is not detailed about that, but it's handing over that to us, the citizens, and to our political representatives.
Mm.
And so we've got to find a way to elevate to a far more creative, more informed, productive process here in New Zealand, but that's true the world over.
I wanted to ask you, let's talk a wee bit about this kind of a segue into this next thing, which is the increase in benefits that we've seen this week brought in by the government, also increased to super, student allowance as well. I guess the tenuous link I'm trying to make there is these are sort of things to support people on an individual basis, but perhaps we need to be looking at how we fundamentally shift our social support services so that it's better meeting the cost of living at the moment. I wanted to know, first of all, what do you think about the changes we've seen this week? Are they welcome changes? Do they go not far enough? Do they go in the right direction? What are your thoughts about these things we've seen brought in?
They're obviously welcome because about 100,000 low-income families had increases in their income by around $60 a week from the beginning of this month. So that's very welcome. But the cost of living gap that's opened up has blown out to something like $300 a week for some families over the past year, according to people in the community that's working on these issues. There's all sorts of problems and distortions. So, for example, the Working for Families program, the rates are only raised once every 5 years, and therefore the increase now doesn't even fully catch up on inflation there's been over that time, whereas superannuation is ratcheted up regularly in line with inflation. And then there are all sorts of tax distortions in these benefits that do disincentivize people from trying to earn more money and still get a reasonable amount of support along the way. So very, very regressive tax rates. And these are issues that are very easily fixed that would be a big help in all this. One last thing is that Stats New Zealand shows this. If you look at the five broad bands of household income, the highest earning group has had the lowest rate of inflation since 2003. It's 20%. But the lower bands and middle bands have had much higher inflation. So that's why getting this right is incredibly important. But I'm still only talking about tweaks, which would be very important to do, rather than a very deep change about making sure people are able to earn better livings for the work they do. And that's a whole different discussion. Well, it's allied, obviously, but that takes us off to into a very big area about the fundamentals of the economy and how it works. Let's not dive into that one right now, but that's ultimately where we need to go.
I did want to get your thoughts, because we had the Prime Minister on the show yesterday, and she sort of alluded to the fact that the government is looking to really focus on health and climate change in the May budget, which is great. I'm sure we're all pleased to hear that. But there was perhaps a noticeable lack of any kind of commitment to looking at that particular social level of change that we need to see to meet all the issues you've just raised there. Do you have any hope for what we might see from the budget in that space, or do you have any, wishes for what you would like to see come out of the budget in May?
Yes. Let me just focus on climate because that's where I spend a lot of my time, and for me it's, you know, the big overarching issue that impacts so much else. The government is still doing policy in a very traditional way. We are the government. We will devise the big strategies and the legislative programs. We will consult with you, and you send us submissions, and we'll make of those what we will. What we need is, and that's terribly slow and cumbersome and suboptimal, with too much timidity in the public service and everything else, and too much fears about the politics. What we need is real co-creation of these policies. So on climate, you bring together all the players and all the interested parties in a sector to work out how they move on. You do engage much more deeply in different ways of doing democracy. I know these are buzzwords, but they have meaning behind them, about deliberative democracy and participatory democracy. That's what's needed here, but we've still got a very traditional and very conventional public service and a very cautious political leadership. And that's not going to get us there. And I'm sympathetic to who they are and what they're doing, but we've got to find ways to encourage them to sort of break out of the self-imposed constraints they have on themselves.
Mm. That might actually be all we have time for this morning, Rod, but it's been very interesting to get your thoughts on these. They're huge topics. We could literally talk about them for hours, we'll come back to them in future weeks as well. But thank you so much for your time, and have a great rest of your Thursday.
Thank you, and you too.
See ya. Bye.
You just heard a bit of political commentary
with Rod.